Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Daytona Beach International Airport, offering new nonstop service to New York City and Boston, Massachusetts. Daytona Beach International Airport features convenient access to the terminal, easy and close parking, and more. Details at flydab.com.
Florida's economy depends on truck drivers. A bill gaining traction in the state Senate says undocumented immigrants driving those commercial trucks pose an immediate threat to safety. You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Sharon Stone. It's Thursday, February 19th, 2026. The Florida Trucking Association says 85% of communities in the state depend on truckers to deliver everyday goods, from groceries to your clothes. Most towns don't have direct access to airports, rail lines, or ports for those daily deliveries, so big rigs are a critical part of keeping Florida running. A regular driver's license isn't enough to get behind the wheel of an 18-wheeler. You need a CDL, or commercial driver's license, which sets a higher standard for operating large vehicles. Each state issues them, but federal rules set the standards that must be followed. On Wednesday, the State Senate Fiscal Policy Committee advanced Senate Bill 86 without debate. The bill was introduced by Republican Don Gates after a deadly crash on the Florida Turnpike near Fort Pierce involving a driver from India and a member of the Sikh community. Florida officials say he was in the country illegally with a California CDL. He is facing three charges of vehicular homicide, accused of making an illegal U-turn in his semi that caused a wreck that killed three people. Here's Senator Gates speaking to the committee yesterday.
Senate Bill 86 declares that the operation of a commercial vehicle by an unauthorized alien is an imminent safety hazard. The bill requires that commercial motor vehicle drivers in Florida must be lawfully present in the U.S., hold a valid CDL license, understand and read English, follow road signs and laws, and be able to communicate with law enforcement.
You may have heard Gates refer to Sikh drivers, though that language does not appear in the bill. We reached out to his office for clarification. A legislative aide responded that the senator misspoke, immediately corrected himself, and the bill applies uniformly to all commercial motor vehicle operators. Under Senate Bill 86, if an officer determines someone without legal status is driving a commercial truck, that person must be taken into custody and transferred to federal immigration authorities. The truck is impounded, and the company that employed the driver can face a $50,000 fine and possible suspension from operating in Florida. For some drivers in the state who follow the rules and hold a valid CDL, new policies being considered are creating fear that they will be targeted unfairly. The international nonprofit United Six reports that truckers in Florida are facing more traffic stops, harassment at rest areas, and online abuse, and that fear is spreading to other immigrant drivers. Data from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics shows around 18% of employed drivers in the trucking industry are foreign-born, meaning immigrant truckers make up nearly 1 in 5 of America's long-haul drivers. Singh is a truck driver in Florida who asked us not to use his full name. He is Sikh and is changing the way he travels through the region.
We have a curtain that I have to cover my top of the driver's side of window so that people don't see me the way I look, you know, try to, you know, target me personally. Because it happened to me before in Florida. Some people had to pull out a gun on me just because the way I look. So most likely whenever I'm in Florida, I just put my curtain up. Hop on my driver's side window.
Even if you are following the rules and you needed help from FHP or law enforcement, in this climate, would you feel comfortable calling for help?
No, right now I'm not comfortable calling law enforcement in Florida.
What would the worst case scenario be for you in a traffic stop?
Well, they would call an immigration and how they're picking people left and right. And they just, even you have a valid vehicle tradition and even you hold a license from any other state, which they call a sanctuary city.
How does it feel when immigration status gets tied to your professionalism or your competence?
Before, we didn't have anything to like worry about it. And since that accident happened, like everybody is scared. People who are in pending process, everybody is scared right now. Some of them like already quit trucking just to be safe. I've been in the country over 10 years, have no criminal record. Never, ever in this time I ever got arrested or have any interaction with the cops, ever.
You've never felt like this targeted before?
Nah, never.
If you have family in Florida,
yeah,
do they worry about you when you're out on the road?
Yes, every day. They don't even know if I'm back home.
To help drivers and their families navigate these challenges, there's a nonprofit called United Six. They're affiliated with the United Nations and provide legal help, community support, and a helpline for truckers and their families. Bhupinder Kaur is director of operations. When people, specifically truckers, contact UMEED in crisis, what are the common fears or challenges that they're facing right now?
They really reflect a mix of fear and confusion and even crisis type of level of stress. The most common fear, of course, is losing their livelihood, and drivers are afraid that just a, you know, routine traffic stop or inspection or paperwork discrepancy could result in some type of suspension or job loss, even when they're lawfully authorized to work. So because obviously their income is their sole support, the confusion about documentation and compliance and fear of profiling and discrimination and, you know, with that comes the mental health distress and fear and instability. Families lose a sense of safety and stability that allows them to thrive. And so the family impact, it follows them home. It's, you know, spouses that are living in that state of chronic stress. You know, children pick up on that anxiety, especially when the parent is late picking them up from school, and they carry that fear that they shouldn't have to hold.
Florida lawmakers are considering Senate Bill 86. It would change how undocumented truck drivers are handled during traffic stops. When you hear about legislation like this, what kind of goes through your mind as someone working directly with vulnerable communities?
I immediately just think about the people who are going to feel this impact first and the hardest, especially with United Six working directly with vulnerable communities. I can see how the fear spreads quickly when the laws are blurring the line between safety and enforcement. And even the possibility that a routine traffic stop could turn into something that's more, can turn people into crisis. With the calls that we're getting through the UMEED helpline, they're worried about their jobs and families and futures.
The laws being presented as making the roads safer, is that what's actually happening?
There's no evidence that laws like this make the roads safer. Like, commercial driving licenses is already built around strict safety standards, and the bill is shifting the focus away from driving performance and vehicle safety towards immigration and paperwork, which doesn't prevent accidents. What it does is, again, create the fear, confusion, and disruption. Our state police and highway patrol officers are public servants that are trained to ensure that roadway safety and regulatory compliance, and they already carry immense responsibility. And embedding immigration control into their workload places, it's an unfair burden on them. And it blurs the clarity of the law that they are meant to uphold. We're grateful for their service, but we shouldn't be asking them to do their jobs that they were never trained or intended to do.
What do you think some of the real life consequences are when undocumented workers, especially drivers, are afraid to interact with law enforcement, even during just a routine stop?
I think safety actually goes down because people avoid reporting accidents or any type of mechanical issues, or maybe they feel unsafe conditions because, you know, they're scared that a simple interaction could escalate. And I think that puts everyone on the road at a greater risk. And beyond that, I think fear drives people into isolation. Of course, jobs will be lost. Families are going to be destabilized. And the trust between communities and law enforcement breaks down. And I don't think, you know, any of those things makes our roads or communities safer.
For Central Florida drivers who are sharing the road with commercial truckers every day, what would you want them to understand about what is happening and the impacts that maybe gets lost?
The people behind the wheel of commercial trucks are trained professionals who are keeping our economy moving. Safer roads come from strong safety standards and mutual respect, not from policies that distract from what actually keeps everyone safe. And we can support public safety and protect due process and civil rights at the same time. So when policies create fear instead of clarity, everyone pays the price. And we should be aiming for solutions that keep our roads safe and our communities stable.
Bhupinder Kaur is United 6 Director of Operations. We just heard Kaur talk about how unfair treatment of immigrant drivers could make highways less safe. Supporters of Senate Bill 86 say it's designed to improve safety and ensure commercial drivers are properly licensed. Todd Spencer is a former trucker and current president of the Owner-Operator Independent Drivers Association, a trade group for professional truckers representing their interests and advocating for fair rules and safe roads. In Florida, SICK trucking groups are saying drivers are experiencing more stops and harassment since enforcement was tightened. How do you think policymakers should address safety concerns without targeting people based on religion or background?
I don't know that you've described a situation where people are targeted by religion or race or background. Certainly, the inspector community, truck inspector, commercial vehicle safety community, their responsibility is to oversee highway safety, and it's regardless of who may be driving the vehicle.
Florida Senate Bill 86 was introduced in the wake of a deadly crash on the turnpike near Fort Pierce, and three people were killed there. Lawmakers say the driver's ability to leave the state exposed a gap in enforcement. I'm wondering, when you look at that case, what kind of questions are raised for you about how commercial drivers are monitored and held accountable?
The unfortunate reality that has come to a head way too frequently, way too often, is the numbers of drivers that are on the road right now that basically shouldn't be on the road, you know, should never have been issued a commercial driver license. In many instances, you know, one, and certainly in some instances, I don't know how many drivers that people that shouldn't even be in the country, people that shouldn't have been issued a commercial driver license simply because they don't have the legal authorization to receive one. And certainly in a growing number of instances, people that have received a commercial driver license without actually going through any kind of training or legitimate testing that demonstrates that they have the qualifications, the capabilities to actually drive a truck safely. I mean, so many loopholes in the system have been certainly exposed. And then, of course, with that, what we see too often is the inability for the current regulatory system to actually address and really remedy the problem.
I want to make sure that I am understanding correctly. Are you seeing a problem with qualification, or do you see this as an immigration problem, or are they tied together?
Some of them, well, both. Too often they are tied together. We hear of instances, currently FMCSA, Department of Transportation, U.S. Department of Transportation, is doing an audit of each state to see if their mechanisms for complying with regulations for granting CDLs, if they're complying with it. And in a shocking number of states, that's not happening. Now, the audits that are going on right now don't provide me with information on Florida yet, but there are over 20 states where identified so far that have shockingly high numbers of commercial driver licenses that were issued that don't comply with existing laws and statutes. We've got to be better than that.
I want to add that FMCSA is the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration. That's the federal agency that regulates commercial trucking in the U.S., and they do control things like who can get a commercial driver's license. I want to ask you then about the best ways to ensure safety. I'll start with Senate Bill 86 again. If a commercial driver is found to be in the country illegally during a traffic stop, they would be detained, the truck impounded, and the owner fined up to $50,000. I'm wondering, from your standpoint, what stands out to you about that approach? Would that help?
To some, that approach might seem hard, but the reality is the current system isn't effective in deterring the violations that are ongoing. This whole issue blew up really, really big a year or so ago when it became clear that there were a shockingly high number of commercial drivers operating on our roads that couldn't speak English. Now, having the ability to communicate in the English language for truck safety purposes has been required in the regulations going back to the 1930s. I mean, it's not different than an airline pilot. The universal language for operation is being able to speak the English language, yet we have large numbers of truck drivers that can't do that. The prevalence of those drivers undergoing inspections was so high that 10 years or so ago, the commercial vehicle inspector community petitioned asking for permission to no longer enforce that regulation. And the reason, one of the principal reasons they did that was because the inspectors didn't think it was safe for them to inspect the truck when they couldn't communicate with the driver. The end result of that is when they discover that they can't communicate with the driver, they simply let the truck go. Now think about that. The inspector is concerned with his safety enough that he doesn't want to inspect the truck, but he makes the decision that it's safe to let it go down the road. Well, that's crazy. That's crazy. Enforcing the regulation would require that that driver be removed from the cab, and that truck can't move until a qualified driver, when I say qualified driver, that means one that actually complies with the regulations, comes to get it. But what actually happens in reality is that driver stays in the truck, and when the scale closes, the driver leaves and goes on down the road. The regulations would require that FMCSA follow up with this company that put the non-qualified driver out on the road. The proposal in Florida would actually require, would create the incentive for that driver in that truck to be held and actually appropriate action take place to remedy the problem, to address the problem. And that's pretty important stuff.
You mentioned that the Florida bill being considered creates an incentive to enforce. Tell me more about that. How does that create an incentive?
The bill actually says the truck is detained and you actually have to pay a significant fine to get it back rather than just simply let it go down the road.
And critics of the bill say it focuses on punishment after a stop rather than preventing a dangerous situation in the first place. I'm wondering how you see that balance. Is it closing an enforcement gap?
The current system isn't effective in enforcement. This would make it effective in enforcement. Certainly, it's in no one's interest that is interested in public safety for a truck and a driver that it's not in compliance with our regulations to simply to be able to continue to operate. Bear in mind, highway safety is the highest concern that our members have. They spend the majority of their working lives out there on public highways with every other driver, and they want to know that those they share the road with at least have some level of safety.
For Central Florida drivers who are sharing the road with these commercial trucks every day, what would you want them to understand about this debate that maybe gets lost sometimes?
Obviously, highway safety is everyone's responsibility. For our folks, the most important element is they want to see every driver on the road, especially truck drivers, but automobile drivers too, be good at what they do, be properly trained. Clearly, when it comes to trucking, it's not acceptable to not do better than we are right now.
Todd Spencer is president of the Owner-Operator Independent Drivers Association. The next stop for Senate Bill 86 would be a floor vote. A companion bill in the House has not had a hearing yet. While this is being debated in Tallahassee at the state level, there's something else happening in Washington. A new federal rule limits who can get or renew a commercial driver's license if they don't permanently live in the U.S. These are people who live in the country legally, but temporarily. Right now, many qualify using a work authorization card. Once the new rule takes effect, only certain visa holders are eligible, and states must verify status more strictly. Federal officials say the change improves safety and prevents fraud. Labor unions and a public interest law group filed a lawsuit challenging it. They argue that asylum seekers, refugees, and DACA recipients who are legally authorized to work shouldn't be prohibited from holding commercial driver's licenses. Unless a court intervenes, this federal rule that was published last week on February 13th is scheduled to go into effect in about a month on March 16th. There's more ahead on Engage. Orlando's representative in Congress turns to crowdsourcing to tackle the Epstein files. The strategy behind using this subreddit, and whether this marks a new chapter in public collaboration and civic engagement. Subscribe to the Engage podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify so you never miss an episode.
There's a lot going on in space, from efforts to land astronauts on the moon
and liftoff of Artemis 1
to answering the age-old question, are we alone in the universe?
Wouldn't you want to know if there was life on another planet?
Are We There Yet? Explores space exploration every Tuesday at 6:30 here on Central Florida Public Media.
You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Sharon Stone. Ahead on this program, the Lunar New Year is here, and Central Floridians are celebrating the Year of the Fire Horse throughout the region.
It is celebrated across many parts of Asia, so it really connects us to our roots and our heritage as well. So it's really meaningful being kind of a first-generation American. My parents are immigrants that moved here and continue this tradition, and so it's really important to be kind of rooted and grounded to keeping my heritage alive.
Engage stops by the Mills 50 District for fireworks, dragons, and a party like no other. But first, today on Engage, U.S. Representative Maxwell Frost of Orlando is a member of the House Oversight Committee, which is investigating the government's handling of the Jeffrey Epstein investigation. Members of Congress were allowed to go to the Department of Justice to review unredacted files tied to the convicted sex offender last week. Frost was given a two-hour appointment to go through the documents. The congressman posted a message online the day before his appointment.
There are millions of these documents that have been released. My staff and I have already identified a lot of the ones that I want to see. But if there's specific documents you think I should view unredacted to help with this investigation, please leave a comment or send me a message and let me know which documents I should view. This isn't about political parties. This is about justice for the survivors and about ensuring that something like this never happens again.
Representative Frost's communications team used the social media and discussion platform Reddit, where users post content organized by topics in forums called subreddits. The Epstein subreddit got millions of views and significant engagement.
If you sent something to the office, please keep sending things through. This is very helpful to us. A special shout out to the thousands on Reddit that responded to my post with specific documents and questions that need to be answered.
Ariana Orne is Maxwell Frost's communications director. She shares their strategy behind using crowdsourcing to gather information and whether this approach is a one-off or something we could see more of in the future. About this strategy, when did you decide to use Reddit with the Epstein files? Why was that the right place to crowdsource information?
So I think for our office, we had a pretty tight window with turnaround when figuring out that Rep Frost could visit the DOJ. And we knew that he was going in for 2 hours. So for us, it was really important to find a quick and strategic method for him to be able to gather and sort of prioritize this information. Obviously, there are millions of files and still so many more to be released. But for us, we were kind of trying to think of a strategic way to get info. And, you know, typically for other offices and what we've done in the past, you'd have folks comment on social media or you'd have folks call into the office. But we noticed that there was a really, really heavy presence on Reddit. There was the R. Epstein subreddit, and there was a lot going on within the conversation of Epstein on Reddit alone. So we kind of sat down, we had a conversation with our chief of staff. We were thinking about ways that we could crowdsource information. And I think the reason why we wanted to crowdsource is just because we live in this digital media environment now, and it's a 24-hour news cycle, and there's so many new things. And not only that, but specifically that folks are really invested in what's happening with these files. And we had seen a couple of TikTok pages where folks were collecting data and they were sharing it with folks and like kind of releasing the files on their own. But we wanted
like one location where they lived in the comments, and we could just go through and we could dig and see what people were already collecting. So that was really kind of the mindset behind it. We knew that having it all in one location would be easy for us to sort of go through and to tag. And in our mind, we wanted to optimize Congressman Frost's time while he was there, since it was such a short window. So sort of looking to the public to see what was of interest to them, I think, was the logic behind why we did it.
I'm thinking for our audience who doesn't know specifically what Reddit is, they just hear Reddit, Twitter, TikTok, Instagram. What about Reddit made it different for you all that made it the ideal place for this public collaboration?
Rep Frost did also post an Instagram video, and we asked folks to leave comments there too. But the Reddit specifically, and why we chose to do Reddit, was because Reddit is sort of built into different communities. One of the things that I use Reddit for is, let's say I'm going to look for like a very niche and specific restaurant and I want to know what folks are saying or if they had been there. Reddit for me is like a first stop before a Yelp or something like that, because the community sort of comes behind things that are good or things that are bad. In a similar vein to finding a restaurant, with the R. Epstein subreddit, there's already a community that exists where people are talking about these things in length. And so to be able to sort of meet the people where they were was a really big thing for us. There's already, you know, millions of comments on the internet about where these files are, what are in them. And so this for us was like a one-stop shop to be able to meet people where they're already focused on like specific topic areas, where with like a Twitter or an Instagram, it's not necessarily as much of a subject-specific community, but for us, this community made it easy to reach the folks that were already sort of diving deep into the Epstein material.
You think it's more accurate for me to say hundreds of people engaged with your posts, or would you say thousands?
We actually had over 6.5 million views on the post. Basically, the function of Reddit is that it expands based on the number of comments. So within the Epstein subreddit, because there were so many comments on the post, Reddit pings that this will be something that's more interesting to the community at large. So it didn't only just live on the R. Epstein subreddit, it also moved over to the R. Popular Reddit page, which is essentially like a homepage where anyone who's scrolling on Reddit that day would also see this post. So it had a ton of volume. Obviously, there's a very large interest for folks to get the answers that they want on the Epstein files.
Did you anticipate that scale of response?
No, not at all. I think we've done Reddits in the past. I've been with this office for 2 months now, so I wasn't with the office when the previous Reddit threads were posted, but we've done an Ask Me Anything in the local Orlando Reddit, and that really got good volume, you know, where Rep Frost is able to sort of learn what is interesting to the community, maybe pieces of legislation or policy issues that people are focused on. So that has already sort of created a space where people were able to interact with our office. We had done it before and knew that it worked, like it was a way to crowdsource, but not by this means. We did not expect this. So it was great. I mean, the community really came together. They shared the links. They shared what was in them. So that also sort of helped our convention in being able to put all of this information together. We're only a full team of 9 in DC, and we only had about 24 hours to put this together. So because folks were leaving these comments, we were able to, you know, organize into clear categories, leave the list, the link, the data sets, the numbers, like the notes on each file, so that when Rep Frost was in there, he basically just had to type in like what we had put on this document for him. So it definitely a different approach, but we were amazed by the amount of people who sort of flocked to this page.
Representative Frost is the first Gen Z member of Congress. Do you see this crowdsourcing becoming more common among younger lawmakers?
I think for sure. We've had a few other offices reach out to us inquiring and asking, you know, what our feedback was and what we thought about it. An example of crowdsourcing would be call into our office and leave a note. And then for each of those, you have either an intern or staff assistant, like filling out forms and typing out things for each of these individuals that called. Where with something like this, it was a list in one place with access to sort of the broadest possible set of insights. And that really gave us like leverage to tap into a collective effort that the community was already practicing.
I want to ask you about amplifying misinformation. How do you assess credibility when you're sourcing from what's an anonymous platform?
Our efforts were mostly spent going directly over to the DOJ website. And the way that we had organized it for the congressman was basically, this is a link to the DOJ website. This is the data set and file number that is with this specific item. And then we categorized. So, you know, we had a Florida section, a Trump section, a video and photo section, because we were worried after seeing that a couple of members had gone, that someone had said that some of the files were still not redacted. Some of the things weren't organized. Like, we wanted to make sure that he really was able to go in, like, with a clear mindset to go through as many files as possible within this timeline. He has barely scraped the surface. We put together a document that was about 11 pages long. And in his 2 hours there, he only made it through 2 pages. So it really speaks to the volume of how many of these links that there were. But that was how we organized. We went back through and we used the links that went to the DOJ website.
Ariana Oren is communications director for U.S. Representative Maxwell Frost. Frost is 29 years old and the first Gen Z member of Congress. To understand whether this Reddit strategy reflects generational differences, let's hear from UCF political science professor Aubrey Jewett. He just talked about what this kind of platform-based participation means for Gen Z civic engagement and digital political communication in one of his classes this week.
You know, it's a clever way in this particular instance, it's a clever way to enlist a lot of people to help with a very large and complex problem. And so that's maybe one of the positive things about social media, right? You have something like the Epstein files, which is like, what, millions of pages. And so if you're trying to make some sense of what's in there, you can't possibly do it all yourself. But if you could enlist a huge number of people who are interested and have looked at all sorts of different things in those files, then contact them over social media via Reddit. And then you won't be shocked at how many hundreds or thousands of responses you'll get.
I'm wondering how you see platforms like Reddit shaping the way younger generations approach political engagement compared to previous generations.
Social media for younger generations is vitally important. And so it's not surprising at all that a younger congressperson would be aware of that and be using social media a lot to try to gather information or to try to influence younger voters. You know, if you look at some of the big researchers that have looked into this, for instance, Pew Research has done a lot of public opinion surveys on this issue. And they have found that different generations use different sources of media. So broadly speaking, if you're younger, say a Gen Z or millennial, say 18 to 40, social media is your primary news source. If you're a Gen X, sort of middle age, say 40 to 60, somewhere in there, you still watch television. You do use some social media, but not nearly as much as the younger folks. And then finally, if you're a baby boomer like myself, right, if you're like 60 or older, you might use a little bit of social media, but not too much.
Frost is the first Gen Z congressman. What do you think makes Gen Z so active in these digital spaces? Is it accessibility, the ability to influence? What do you think's going on?
Bottom line is, yeah, those younger voters, it literally is all they know. They were born into this and they have really taken to it. And I might add the tech companies, of course, have tailored these systems to try to appeal to these younger voters as well. So it's a two-way street there.
Can we expect to see more elected officials and political leaders using platforms like social media, like Reddit, for engagement?
I would think so, absolutely, for any elected politician who is trying to make a connection with younger voters, this is really becoming a must. And again, if you have a younger congressperson like Maxwell Frost, who's, I think, the youngest in Congress currently, this comes naturally to him. You know, he knows, hey, the people that are some of my core supporters are young folks like myself. And I know what I do as a young person, so I know what they do. And so this is how I can, again, solicit feedback. This is how I can communicate with them. But for a lot of middle-aged and older congressional reps, or even state reps and state senators, this is a learning curve. Obviously, they are aware of social media and they know it's important, but sometimes it's a little more difficult to really understand it and really embrace it unless you're actually a member of that generation. I will say a number of these older congressional reps and state reps do hire younger staff people to do these things, right? Because even if they're not aware or really up to date and doing it themselves, they're more and more realizing how important it is. And so typically they'll either have a paid staffer or maybe paid somebody on their campaign staff to do these things.
I always am worried about misinformation. And given the ease with which that can spread online, what role do these platforms like Reddit play in verifying information to make sure what's being shared is credible?
That is a really big fear. And when I talk about the role of the media in politics in my classes, like my Florida politics class, that's something that we talk about. How traditional media and traditional professional journalists who had training and who had some guidelines and who generally could be trusted to tell the truth. Certainly one party or the other might suggest a particular news source or reporter maybe had a little spin or was slanted a little bit one way or the other. But the bottom line was you could rely on the basic factual information to be true, or at least mostly true, under the old system. But now with social media, there are really just no guidelines or barriers or any real way to consistently verify what's real and what's not. Because virtually anybody can now claim to, you know, be a quote unquote journalist, and they just post things. And for better or for worse, usually for the worse, the way these social media platforms work, the algorithms are saying, hey, if you can get more clicks, you'll get promoted and you'll earn more money if you're running a website or trying to get more people to come to your website. And so, of course, we know that sensationalism sells. And so a lot of these social media sites will contain misinformation or really severely distorted information solely because they seem so outrageous that they can get people to click. And again, you got to tie that together with, remember that a lot of those younger voters aren't actually looking for news. And so they're stumbling across things. And so they're not necessarily the most informed consumers of news. So that's a long-winded way of saying that, yeah, it's a real challenge in our social media age, particularly for younger voters, to know what is factual and what is not. Just anecdotally, I have 5 kids ranging in age from 22 to 32. And so over the last decade, a lot of times they'll come up to me and they'll say, Dad, did you see this? And sometimes it's factual and interesting. And I'll say, yeah, I have. Or occasionally it's like, I haven't, right? Because sometimes you get breaking news more quickly across the internet. But a lot of times they come and they say, Dad, did you see this? And I'll say, no, but I don't think that's true. And then we'll take 5 minutes and we'll go online and we'll do a little searching and discover that indeed what they thought was something factual and maybe outrageous and turned out to be just outrageous, but really it's made up and it's not true.
What advice would you give to politicians who want to effectively engage Gen Z in these digital spaces?
You've got to get on Instagram and TikTok and Reddit. Currently, those are the top 3 platforms by far for that generation. It probably will help if you have somebody that is a member of Gen Z on your staff to handle your social media, because they will be much more in tune to what those younger voters are looking for or what they're more likely to click on. And then, you know, last but not least, I would say this is based on my 30 years as a college professor teaching young people, you know, have some respect for your audience and understand that even though they're young, they are very bright. They are interested in certain issues, and treat them with some respect.
Aubrey Jewett is associate professor and associate director of the School of Politics, Security, and International Affairs at UCF. Coming up, dragons dancing and dazzling colors. We are taking you to the heart of Orlando's Lunar New Year celebration. And we're going on a hamcation, a look at the annual expo for amateur radio operators. You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media.
The Wrap is a podcast from Central Florida Public Media, curating the top Central Florida news stories and in-depth reporting each week. Join me, Brendan Byrne, as I bring you news headlines, deep reporting dives, and insightful conversations from the news team. A new episode of The Wrap every Friday morning. Get it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Sharon Stone. Before the internet, before cell phones and texting, people used radios to communicate with others, both short and very long distances. Amateur radio, also known as ham radio, became a popular recreation in post-war America. Anybody could buy a kit or fully assembled radio and start reaching out to other enthusiasts using radio waves similar to those carrying the signal you might be listening to now. Kind of like over-the-air pen pals. Operators would challenge themselves to send and receive signals as far as they can, sometimes while trying to use the least amount of power. And on a clear, cold night, a knowledgeable radio operator can reach the other side of the world using just a low-power radio transmitter. Ham radios also play an integral role in emergency communications, providing citizens with a way to share information as well as broadcast for help. While this seems rather benign in the digital age, there are still many ham radio operators and many clubs around the world. Many gathered this past weekend at the Central Florida Fairgrounds and Expo Park for Hamcation, an annual expo for amateur radio operators featuring product manufacturers and clubs from around the country. Engage producer Richard Copeland stopped by to meet John Gillette, an Oviedo resident and member of the Orlando Amateur Radio Club, the organizers of Hamcation. Gillette spoke about who is using ham radios in the 21st century.
Well, there are people that come from all walks of life. Goes all the way from high school students. I work with scouts that are learning amateur radio. And then all the way up to octogenarians. People that have been doing this since the 1940s, 1950s. And everywhere in between. And people that come from all different walks of life, all different career fields. Personally, I'm a government employee. I work for the Army as a project manager and come from a communications background. Got into amateur radio through that. There are others that have gotten in through scouting. And some people just are looking for alternate means of communications if we have a hurricane or something like that. And so amateur radio, they certify as a technician. So they have that extra means of communications that they can get out of a zone if our cell towers are down or if the telephone lines are down.
Now, I remember when I was a kid, I had friends whose fathers were into this, you know, in the garage. But you mentioned that high schoolers are getting into this. What brings somebody that young who has that much access to that many outlets into radio?
What I'll say is the wow factor. One thing that we have around here is we're very close to Kennedy Space Center and Cape Canaveral with the U.S. Space Force. There is a program within amateur radio where a high school can apply, or even an elementary school can apply, as has happened here at Sally Ride Elementary School. And the school gets together, they learn about radio, they learn about making contacts, and then at the culminating exercise, they actually contact the International Space Station and talk to an astronaut using our ham radios.
Pretty old school.
Yeah, exactly. When you see the students light up, one, when they make an initial contact and they say, hey, I'm talking to someone, but it's not over my cell phone. It's not, over the computer. I'm using radio waves. And then they get to the point where the space station comes over and they're talking to an astronaut who's actually in space. Really, you can feel the energy in the building. Scouts the same way. As the scouts come in, we have what's called a jamboree on the air every October, generally around the middle of October. And we get scouts together in different areas, that boat out the scout camp here in around Orlando at Camp La Noche, or we do it in other locations like VFWs. Scouts come in and we have different types of radios set up, and we make contacts not only around the country but around the world and have them plot their contacts on the map. And so it shows, one, that idea that we are a global community and they can reach out through more things than just the internet or through their cell phones.
How did you personally get involved with broadcasting?
So two ways. First of all, my grandfather in the Midwest, he was a ham radio operator. That's how I knew about it. But where I became involved and got certified was I was a project manager for SATCOM for the Army. And I did grow up in a communications background. I was an artillery officer. And I asked one of my engineers, who is a veteran, and said, hey, I'm struggling here a little bit, and I don't have the classes that I would. And he goes, here, handed me the technician book, said, take this. I said, you'll know most of it, but it will help you to understand what we're talking about when we're talking about that. So I had the program management background, and he helped me get the technical background through ham radio. From there, then, I was able to just take that and continue to get my certifications after that and just expand it out to emergency radio, to the club, and then also to scouting.
From a recreational standpoint, there's something of a treasure hunt in sending out a signal, trying to see how far you can send the weak signal, see how far you can get a response from. You personally, how far have you been able to reach out across the globe?
Furthest I've got is the Philippines and Malta for my HF radio. The furthest I've gotten up to this point is Canada, and then out as far as the West Coast, out to San Diego. I just recently got a new radio and got a new radio here as well that has a little bit more power. I'm looking forward to cracking that open and seeing if I can get to Europe directly with high frequency.
Yeah, this place looks like it's chock full of toys.
Exactly, it is. It's dangerous for the wallet.
I can imagine.
That was Engage producer Richard Copeland speaking with John Gillette of the Orlando Amateur Radio Club at this past weekend's Hamcation Expo. Celebrations are happening across Central Florida this week to mark the start of the Lunar New Year on the Chinese calendar. The Chinese zodiac is on a 12-year cycle, and each is associated with one of 12 animals and one of five elements. For the first time in six decades, it is the year of the Fire Horse, a combination described as high energy and intense. The Wallum Kung Fu Temple performance team held several opening ceremony shows at local businesses in Orlando on Tuesday, February 17th, the first day of the Lunar New Year. Lion dancers in their vivid, colorful costumes leaped and twirled to the beats of banging drums. Sifu Mimi Chan is the team leader.
We are from the Wallum Kung Fu Temple in Orlando, Florida. We started this tradition in 1981. We're the first ones to actually bring the Lunar New Year celebrations to the Central Florida area. And what that entails is the traditional lion dance with music and firecrackers and all of the loud, exciting sounds that help scare away all the evil spirits, bring in and usher good luck for the new year, bring positivity and joy, good health, prosperity to the businesses that have us come out and celebrate this very, very important holiday, which is the Lunar New Year. This year is the year of the Fire Horse.
Since you brought it up, what is the year of the Fire Horse symbolize?
Well, the year of the horse, you know, horses are very hard workers and they're moving progress forward, bold, passion. It's a year of change. So every year we kind of say we hope it's a good luck year.
What does this moment represent to you?
For me particularly, I am Chinese American, so as an Asian American, the Lunar New Year is one of my most important holidays. It really ushers in that, kind of start to what we hope is going to be a prosperous and healthy year. And it is celebrated across
many parts of Asia. So it really connects us to our roots and our heritage as well. So it's really meaningful being kind of a first generation American. My parents are immigrants that moved here and continue this tradition. And so it's really important to be kind of rooted and grounded to keeping my heritage alive.
You've also worked to expand Asian American Pacific Islander history education in Florida.
Yes.
Do celebrations like this help people feel seen?
Absolutely. I mean, what is really great about this, if you could see and look around, there is a huge diverse community celebrating with us. It is not just Asian Americans celebrating Lunar New Year. We involve and help educate the community and also bring it together so that everybody is participating and everybody is a part of the celebration. So it really helps people understand us as well. And as part of Make Us Visible Florida, I was responsible for bringing AAPI history into our public school system. And so we're really excited that that has begun. And so these celebrations are definitely essential and important, but historically, it's like we just want our Asian American history and stories to be told.
What do you love most about the performance?
What I love most about the performances is the end of the day when we all get to rest. No, I'm just kidding. What I love most is seeing multiple generations celebrating. We have kids in here who are 3 or 5 years old that are now in their 20s, 30s, 40s that continue to celebrate with us year after year, and seeing that tradition passed down and continuing as part of the Wollum legacy.
To someone who has never been to a New Year celebration, what would you say to them?
I would say you need to get out and celebrate the Lunar New Year. There is nothing like it. Once anyone celebrates, it often becomes their favorite holiday.
The celebration continues this weekend. The 14th annual Dragon Parade Lunar New Year starts at 11 a.m. Sunday, February 22nd in Orlando's Mills 50 District. That's all for this week's edition of Engage. Remember, we always want to hear from you. Let us know what you'd like to hear more about or what you're glad you heard. Send an email to engage@cfpublic.org or send a talkback on the free Central Florida Public Media app. I'm Sharon Stone. Thank you for the company. NPR News is next.